I were to ask you which inspired author provided the most content of the New Testament, you would probably guess the Apostle Paul. He penned the 13 letters or epistles in the New Testament, but the answer would be no. It wasn't Paul. If you guessed the Apostle John, and you thought, well, he wrote the Gospel of John and the book of Revelation in three short letters, 1st through 3rd John, again, you'd be wrong. And these were my answers, by the way, as I thought through it. One New Testament author who wasn't even an apostle, in fact, he's an uncircumcised Gentile physician, happened to write the most. It's a two-volume bestseller, we could call it. His name is Luke. Volume one of his two-part series is called The Gospel of Luke. Volume two is called The Book of Acts. In sheer volume alone, 25% of the content of the New Testament is written by Luke, this converted doctor. Each of these two volumes are written to the same person, an imperial official, given the term excellent, or you could render it your excellency, the same term Paul will use when addressing two different governors on two different occasions in Acts 23 and Acts chapter 26. In the second volume, Luke writes in Acts chapter 1 and verse 1, in the first book, O Theophilus, I have dealt with all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day when he was taken up. That's how his second volume begins. And from that point, volume 2 reveals the details behind the arrival of the Holy Spirit, the creation of the New Testament church, and the early actions of the Spirit-filled apostles. Back in volume 1, in Luke's gospel, at the outset of this two-volume series, Luke tells Theophilus exactly why he was moved to compile it. Verse 1 begins, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. That's the purpose statement for this two-volume series. Now, Luke, we know, if you put the clues together, was the traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. It's obvious to me that he was, because what I just read in Luke 1, 1 to 4 is actually one long sentence. He sounds like Paul, doesn't he? And the key word to this purpose statement, if you have your Bibles open, you might underline or circle it, is the word certainty. That you might have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Theophilus, I want you to be certain. I want you to grasp with assurance. I want you to have an understanding fully of this gospel. This happens, by the way, to be a wonderful coincidence that the man's name is Theophilus. Theophilus means friend of God. It's applicable then to every believer, isn't it? Almost immediately. Up to this point, today, he's writing to the friends of God. Those of you who've come to faith in Jesus Christ, in fact, Luke will stress in this gospel account that Jesus is a real man. 100% divine, yes, but 100% human. By faith in the God-man, we've become not only children of God, but you happen to be a friend of God. You know, people get all excited about who their friends are. Let me tell you, you're one of the friends of God. Luke wants the believer to develop this certainty, this foundation for his faith, and the evidence along the way to encourage the faith of believers. In fact, he says here in this opening sentence that he's examined the testimonies of eyewitnesses. He's reviewed the accounts. Traveling with Paul, he would have talked to many believers, hundreds of them, who had seen the Lord, who'd walked with the Lord, who'd watched the miracles of the Lord, even though Luke himself is not an eyewitness. He's going to use a word for interviewing these eyewitnesses found nowhere else in the New Testament. It's the Greek word autoptes. It gives us our word autopsy. Only a doctor would come up with that word. He's carefully examining the historical record. He's compiling, he's arranging, he's diagnosing all the facts. He's giving us the autopsy. Here it is. I'm laying it out for you with historical markers along the way. Beloved, Christianity never once said to anybody, close your eyes, turn off your thinking cap, and try to believe. Never. No, what Christianity says is, check out the evidence. Look at the autopsy report of careful analysis. Check it out. Look at it carefully. Look at this man, his birth, his life, his death, his resurrection. Look at him in all the perfection of his glory and believe. The God who came into our cluttered world, our chaotic world, our condemned world, this is the God-man who will say in Luke chapter 19, I've come to seek and to save those who are lost. Would you like to become a friend of God? Look at the evidence and believe. Frankly, I don't think there's a better time to rehearse the truths about Jesus Christ and the gospel of Christ and the claims of Christ in these days of chaos and clutter. When Jesus is being erased from the pages of our world's consciousness. Let's allow this gospel to do in our own hearts what Tertullian said it did to Christians living just 50 years after the death of Luke. Tertullian wrote that Luke's gospel renewed their faith. It reinvigorated, it refreshed their faith. Let's ask God to do this in our own lives as well. Now, with that as a backdrop, you might think that Luke then, in order to develop the certainty of our faith, would dive in to the narrative of Christ's birth. But Dr. Luke isn't in a hurry. In fact, he's going to write the longest book in the New Testament. And so what that means in terms of our sermon series, one can only imagine. But what he's going to do is he's going to introduce two people to us who have every reason to be lagging in their faith, discouraged in their walk with God, defeated. In fact, they were discouraged. And let me say, just simply by way of introduction, that the culture may change and the context may change between the first century and the 21st century, but the truths that develop, reinforce, refresh, reinvigorate our faith remain the same today. So let me take you through these opening texts by laying it out this way. Let me give you three unchangeable truths for every heart that needs to be refreshed today. Truth number one. Even when God's authority seems unimportant, or you could add irrelevant, he is still in control. Notice how the gospel account now opens in verse 5. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. I love the way that's juxtaposed. In the days of Herod, there was a priest. Let me tell you, you can write into the margin of your notes or in your mind, this is a terrible time to be a priest. This is the worst time to walk with God. This would be a terrible time to try to represent God. In the days of Herod, there's a priest. This is Herod the Great, by the way. We're going to see him surface. This is the one who orders the death of every male in order to cling to the title he loves the most, which happens to be King of the Jews. He garnered it. He will kill three of his sons so they won't represent a threat to his throne. He had 9 or 10 wives, we're not even sure, although we know he executed one of them for no apparent reason. Add to that the fact that during these days, the religious leadership of the temple system is utterly corrupt, spiritually bankrupt, shackled to traditions, rebelling in their hearts against the word of God. And we'll see that when Jesus arrives on the scene. God no longer matters in the political realm or even in the religious realm. God is essentially unimportant. He is virtually irrelevant. Sounds like today, doesn't it? So to be living during the reign of Herod, well, that was bad enough. But to be a priest embedded in a corrupt religious system only added to the challenges. See, Luke is setting the scene to reteach this unchangeable truth here. Even when God is set aside, he's still in control. Don't be mistaken. Truth number two. Even when God seems absent, he is still aware of every sorrow. Go to verse 5 again. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Let's stop here for another moment. During these days, the priesthood was made up of several thousand men, up to 10,000 men, who were placed into 24 divisions. They would serve for a week at a time, twice a year. Now, Luke tells us here that Zechariah was in the division of Abijah. What that means is he's one of the less significant priests. He didn't live inside the city of Jerusalem. This division was fairly insignificant in the larger scheme of the religious world. These priests were not well connected. They didn't hold special offices. They lived out in what we would call today the country. These were country priests. More than likely, he's farming on the side to make ends meet. He's faithfully married for decades now to Elizabeth. Luke tells us that she was a direct descendant of Aaron, Israel's first high priest. And he tells us that they both loved God and walked with him. Look at their testimony in verse 6 here. And they were both righteous before God. That is, they were right with God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. Now, don't think for a moment that Luke is describing perfect people. They don't exist. He's describing passionate people here. Persistent people. Purposeful people. And keep in mind, they had every reason to assume that God wasn't really all that aware of them. God wasn't granting them the promises of the covenant they were working hard to defend and serve. You would expect Luke to follow up this kind of glowing testimony by telling us they had a wagon load of children. But instead, barrenness. This would be presumed to be a sign of God's withholding of his blessing for some reason during these Old Testament days. Obedience led to a fruitful womb. That was the covenant promise spelled out in Deuteronomy 7:14 during these days of the Old Testament covenant promises. People automatically assumed then that something must be wrong somewhere. I mean, Zechariah and Elizabeth seem to walk with God, but God hasn't opened her womb, so there's got to be something else going on behind closed doors here, which is why Luke emphasized their godly character. Don't think for a moment they're being judged by God, even though it might look like it during these covenant days. In fact, if you skip ahead to the end of the chapter or the end of this section, Elizabeth is going to rejoice that God has taken her reproach away from among the people. That's a loaded statement. They've lived under this cloud. By the way, the rabbis were teaching during these days, the legalistic traditions, that there were several kinds of people who weren't able to enjoy close communion with God. Now, by the way, they were making it up. They were binding people with their traditions, but they said there were several kinds of people. One was a man who was single and didn't have a wife. Second was a couple that didn't have a child. Of course, Jesus himself will be born into this system, and he will shatter these misconceptions. He never had a wife. He never fathered any children. But is there anyone who ever had closer communion with God the Father than Jesus? This is the religious cloud. I want you to feel it. When it says there's a priest and a faithful wife, they're not getting patted on the back. They don't have apparent, obvious payback from God. With that as a backdrop, we're told here in verse 8 that Zechariah's division of several hundred priests is now called up to fulfill that week of service. Verse 9 tells us that lots were cast to determine which priest among them had the special privilege of burning incense inside the holy place, just outside the Holy of Holies. This, by the way, would have been the high point, the high moment of a priest's entire ministry. In fact, a priest, we know, could only do this one time in his entire lifetime of ministry. And among 10,000 priests, many of them never got this chance. So here is Zechariah, probably in his last round of his priesthood. He's chosen by lot to pour frankincense over the hot coals of that altar just inside the holy place. I picture him stepping in there for the first time and only time in his life, awestruck as we would be. He looks around at the furniture as he sees the candelabra and the table and the showbread and that massive curtain, 30 feet high, about this high, separating him from the Holy of Holies on the other side. To be that close would be awe-inspiring. At this moment, Zechariah is representing Israel in the prayers of the nation as this sweet-smelling frankincense is billowing the smoke. It would have been awe-inspiring. We're told here in verse 10 that outside is a multitude of worshipers. Those that have gathered, they're praying. They're joining in this man who represents them as they're praying to God as he performs this sacred task. I mean, look at this. I mean, for a country priest who'd faithfully served the Lord, for a man and his wife who no doubt wondered why the blessing of God was always on somebody else, I imagine he can't wait to get home and tell Elizabeth what God had done. Now, about the time that billowing smoke clears the air, he realizes he's not alone. Look at verse 11. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, And fear fell upon him. That's the biblical way of saying he nearly passed out. You know, Gabriel probably had smelling salt to help him. Now remember, by the way, this is the end of what we call the 400 years of intertestamental silence. When Malachi put his quill down, until this moment, God has been silent. No angel sightings anywhere. Nobody's seeing angels in the clouds or in their enchilada or wherever. No angels anywhere. No word from God until this moment. Verse 13. The angel said to him, what angels typically say to humans, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah." Now notice this incredible revelation. "For your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. And you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness." That's the understatement of the year. "And many will rejoice at his birth." Gabriel then goes on to describe the prophetic ministry of John the Baptizer, as he will become known. We'll look at it later. The forerunner, the announcer of his cousin, who happens to be Jesus, God the Son, the Messiah. Now go back to the first part though. "For your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear a son. You're going to call him John." Wait a second here. This wasn't his prayer in the holy place. He's praying for the nation, as he represents them. He's praying for the Redeemer to come. He's probably praying a few prayers for his own religious leaders, and he might have even been praying for Herod. He's not praying for Elizabeth to have a son. At this point, they are both in their late 70s. Some scholars believe the phrase "well advanced" applied to those in their 80s. Zechariah prayed this prayer 50 years ago. He and Elizabeth wept together as they prayed this prayer 40 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, but time ran out. They're not praying this. He's not praying this. He's an 80-year-old man. So imagine this. I mean, they got a spare room that's never going to be used. The sound of children playing in their homes never going to be heard. It'll never echo around their walls. God has seemed absent, the heavens silent. But imagine this revelation. Gabriel says, "You know that prayer you prayed 50 years ago? God heard that. You know those prayers you and Elizabeth prayed 30 years ago? God heard your prayer. God knew every time you prayed for a child. But it wasn't time. It wasn't his will. God knew when you stopped praying for a child. How long have you been waiting for some answer to prayer? 4 weeks? 4 months? 4 years? Can you imagine 40? 50? And then realizing you can stop praying. Even when God seems absent, guess what? He's still aware of every sorrow and every longing and every prayer. Let me provide one more unchangeable truth as we work through this text. Even when things seem impossible, God is able to do the unimaginable. Now, I got to add here, Zechariah isn't buying it. I wonder if I would, or you. He asks the angel in verse 18, notice, "How shall I know this? For I'm an old man, and my wife is advanced in years." By the way, husbands, there's a lesson in diplomacy here. Do you notice Zachariah says, I'm an old man, but my wife is advanced. He's a brilliant man here, a wise priest. I'm old, man. My wife, well, she's advanced. How's this going to happen? By the way, later in chapter 1, Mary is going to say to the same angel, how's this going to happen? But her question's different from Zechariah's. How can a virgin be carrying a child? She doesn't understand that process. For Zechariah, on the other hand, he doesn't believe that he and his advanced wife of many years, you know, can pull this off. For Mary, it will be a question of biology. For Zechariah here, it is a matter of belief. He wants proof. He wants a sign, which I think is hilarious. He's standing here talking to an angel. I need a sign from God. Hello? Here's the conversation, verse 18 again. How shall I know this? I'm an old man and my wife is advanced in years. The angel answered, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God who was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. First time you hear that expression. Good news. Notice the wordplay here though. Did you catch that? Zechariah says, I'm an old man. The angel says, I'm Gabriel. And I stand in the presence of God. Who cares how old you are? When things seem impossible, that happens to be the perfect time. I wonder if Gabriel chuckled. He'd seen over the course of human history, God move at that impossible moment to perform his will. Oh man, you're old, but I'm Gabriel. And you can't believe what I've seen. I stand in the presence of God. He goes on to announce, though, that because of unbelief, Zechariah is not going to be able to talk or hear for the next 9 months plus. There may be a play on this, that God has shattered the silence after 400 years, and now because of your unbelief, I'm going to have you spend 9 months in silence. He can't speak. Later on in the chapter, we learn he can't hear either. Total silence. He finishes his service, we're told, verse 23, and he heads home. I can imagine he is so filled with awe and fear and amazement and joy all rolled up. He can't wait to tell Elizabeth the news. Can you imagine? I mean, he's probably got his mule up to 3 miles an hour. He's just prodding that thing along. He rushes into the house. He grabs Elizabeth, tries to mouth the words. She can't get it. That doesn't work. So he starts playing charades, you know, two syllables rhymes with maybe, you know, and he starts doing hand motions. You're going to have a baby. This is all in the Greek text, okay? I had to dig to get it. She's probably thinking he's lost his mind when he says, you, baby. No doubt she can see the earnestness on his face, maybe tears running down his cheeks. God had heard their prayers decades ago. Now, at the most impossible of seasons, God the Creator is going to turn the clock back and perform the miraculous. At the end of the chapter here in verse 24, we're told that she conceives and then she stays hidden indoors for the next 5 months. I love that. What does that mean? Is she uncertain? Is this for real? Who can believe our joy? Can you see them getting a family portrait 10 months later? Hey, good to see you guys. You're coming in here to get a picture with your great-grandson. Oh, this is our boy. We had him a couple of months ago. I mean, this would really mess somebody up at Olin Mills, I'm fairly convinced. Luke is the only gospel writer, by the way, who gives us so many prenatal and postnatal details, probably because God used his experience as a doctor. But he evidently loved people. Paul will call Luke the beloved physician. He loved life. You get the impression from the way he writes, as we'll learn together, that he would have been someone who would have been a lot of fun to be around. Wonderful, encouraging to be around. In fact, the word, the verb rejoice, is found more times in Luke's gospel than any other New Testament book. The phrase, praise God, occurs more times in the gospel of Luke than all the other books of the New Testament combined. I get the picture. This guy just has a smile on his face and he loves rolling out the news here of great joy. The certainty of our faith is built on these unchangeable truths which lead us into joy at our great, good Creator God. Even when his authority is considered irrelevant in our world, he's in total control. Even when God seems absent, silent, he's still aware of every sorrow, every pain. Even when things seem impossible, God is ready at his timing according to his will. He's fully capable to do the unexpected. He's fully able to do the unimaginable, the miraculous. So he introduces us first to this good news. And I just want us to stop and consider that family portrait. There's this old man grinning from ear to ear, Zechariah. His name means God remembered. And he did. Next to him is an elderly, advanced woman of years, and she's smiling. Elizabeth's name refers to the faithfulness of God. And he was. And this little boy bouncing perhaps around, his name is John, which means God is gracious and good. And he is. With that, Gabriel is going to be commissioned by the Lord to deliver another unexpected message. He delivered a message to Zechariah that his wife, who would never expect to have a baby, will. Next, Gabriel is going to go to a young woman who shouldn't be expecting a baby, but is. And Luke is leading us into the miraculous, life-changing, Messiah-coming, silence-shattering declarations of joy. This is good news of great joy.